turning to the confirmation security and border control, which is starting a bit later than but that's not unusual for us. Welcome to Daniel Gaffney, Sanger Institute, who will talk about that thing on the screen.
Yep. Hopefully.
Whatever that means, hope to know by the end of the day.
Thank you. Well, if you don't, then I haven't done my job. So thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to come and talk to you about our work. So I'm a group leader at the Sanger. I thought I would start by just showing you some of the people in our group, and we have a mixture of backgrounds and interests, somewhat unified by the theme of genetics, of gene expression or gene regulation. But we have a range of people who come from computer science and statistics to people who are doing molecular biology and working in stem cells, and I'm sort of strategically placed in between because I have a little bit of a mixed background from sort of general science, biology and zoology, but moved into evolutionary biology and then statistics and population genetics fairly early on. And I'll motivate my talk by showing you this slide, which you may or may not have seen before, but to explain, this is a picture of the genome. This is the chromosome, and each one of these little dots that you can barely see indicates an association, a locus in the genome that's been linked with a particular human trait, something like height, disease risk, and so on. And this is from a few months ago, and I don't expect you to be able to see any of the individual dots. What it's supposed to convey is the scale and progress in discovery of the genetic architecture of human variation.
When you say there are that number of trait associations,
yes.
Does that refer to the total number of loci on the gene which are associated with some traits, and it's not that there are 29,000 different traits?
No, correct. It is, so for example, for certain traits you have scores or hundreds of hits. The people have done genetic association studies for, at this point, many hundreds or thousands of traits. And bear in mind, some of those traits may be not quite at the level of the whole organism, like height, but they may be blood metabolites, for example, of which you can measure quite a few. But many of these are, for whole organism, height, disease risk, and so on. And what's amazing about this is this really has only happened in the course of about a decade. Before that time, human genetics was quite a difficult thing to make progress in. People did many studies in families looking at rare disease, but also did what were called candidate gene studies, which is where you a priori pick one of these loci that you think may be interesting for your trait of interest, and you look at it in a certain number of people and hope that you find some relationship. And those were not very successful. And the major shift has been towards, as some of you may know, towards very large sample sizes. And the reason for that is that many of these associations are very small effects, and you need very, very large sample sizes to pick them up. But technology has driven that. The price of genotyping people became very, very cheap. And at the same time, the communities involved became much more collaborative because they realized that was what was required to make progress. So instead of people doing analysis on cohorts of 800 here and 1,000 here, people came together and brought all their samples together into one analysis and meta-analysis. And now, actually, the UK is at the forefront of leading, you know, the largest studies of its type in the world. The UK Biobank is making progress on doing analysis on 500,000 people, and these will inevitably keep going up and up and up. So And I'm not going to talk to you about genetic architecture of human traits at that level, but this is our sort of motivational slide. The other motivational slide I showed a little bit earlier in the discussion, well, before the talk, was this. And what this is supposed to illustrate is that those human associations are important for understanding human variation, but they're also important for understanding disease and understanding how we can develop better therapeutics. What this is supposed to show, this is an odds ratio, so this is an enrichment of known drug targets near or in genes that have been associated via genetic studies. And there are different types of genetic studies. AMIM refers to rare genetic variants, and GWAS refers to the picture I showed you before, so more common genetic variants that are found in otherwise sometimes in healthy people. But you can see there is some signal here for enrichment of known drug targets for those genes that have also been identified by genetic studies. So this is just to illustrate that there is some signal here, not just for understanding human variability, but for drug development, for therapeutics.
So how do we see the signal there that the odds ratios are larger for the what exactly are we supposed to be seeing?
So this is the fold enrichment of known drug targets near AMIM, near rare disease genes. This is for AMIM or GWAS genes. The thing you're supposed to be looking at is if you were to identify targets, drug targets, only based on GWAS, so only based on common genetics, you would still be relatively enriched rather than just taking a random sample of genes in the genome. If that makes sense. Okay. That is a good question. I suspect it is natural log.
Right.
I'm not sure.
So these lower ones are basically a log ratio of around e squared.
Something like that.
So something like 5:1.
Which still isn't bad if it's narrowing down the genome by. It's not enough, but it's a lot better than random. Where we sort of jump off from is thinking about how one could make progress with these. So if I go back to the previous slide, you know, this is what comes from GWAS, this is what comes from common genetic studies. You get a locus in the genome, it is not resolved to a particular gene or a particular variant. And what we know now is that most of the things that we find in GWAS and common genetic studies are not affecting, at least directly, the structure of a protein. So the causal variant that's driving your risk for disease is not sitting in, you know, an amino acid that's coding for a particular, or a codon that's coding for amino acid that's affecting your protein. It's sitting somewhere else in the genome outside of a known gene, and it's affecting the regulation or the expression of that gene. Yes?
Well, you see more specifically transcripts, because there are people who advocate doing exon sequencing.
Correct.
Exactly the opposite. And you...
So I think the difference...
number for this.
So I think the difference there is exon sequencing can be done for different types of study designs, but what we're talking about explicitly here is common genetic variants. So exon studies are often done with rarer diseases, so cystic fibrosis or muscular dystrophy and so on. And there the analysis is slightly different. What you're looking for are extremely rare variants that have never been seen in healthy individuals. The type of analysis one would do there is you say, well, I see this variant or variants in this gene tend to be more enriched than I see it in healthy people in the population. So the two things you're banking on there, first, they're much more penetrant. The variants that you see are much more likely to have you're much more likely to get the disease if you have the variant. And by extension, things that have large effects tend to localize in genes.
It still would be nice to see the most specializations that equate. Is it 90%?
It is 90%. I can show you a slide if you like. But so the best guess for most traits in this picture is between 85% and 90%. And so that comes from, when you look at these loci, and you say, well, in my interval, my associated window of, I don't find a single missense variant, so I don't find a mutation in any known gene, protein coding gene, and those are reasonably well annotated. So if they were there, those would be relatively easy to find, but in about 10% of cases we can find them. In the remainder, we don't find any variant in a gene. So our assumption is that most of these are what are called non-coding. They sit outside known genes, and they must function, or at least, unless we've missed a huge piece of molecular biology, they must function by what's called regulation of genes, which means that they affect when the gene is switched on, switched off, or how much it goes up or down in response to stimulus, for example. And there's an interesting kind of implication of that, which is that, so the genome is made up of coding and non-coding sequence. It's mostly non-coding. There, perhaps 2%, 1 to 2% is actually codes for protein. And most of the non-coding stuff, i.e. most of the stuff where these genetic associations lie, is not conserved in animals, in animal models. So, for example, mice. If I want to study the effect of a variant that I found in my GWAS, I can't easily model it in a mouse, because that piece of DNA is not there anymore. It's not conserved between the two species. The same couldn't, you know, you can say something about genes. Genes tend to be conserved more often in mouse than not, but non-coding DNA is generally not. So that's what we're interested in. We're interested in non-coding variants that affect gene expression, because they're interesting for disease, they're interesting for drug discovery. And the final-ish introductory slide I'll give you is this is a picture of a GWAS association. So for those of you who haven't seen this before, this is what's called a Manhattan plot. It doesn't really make much sense in this when it's zoomed in, but what you're seeing here is a piece of the genome, perhaps of the order of a megabase or so in size, so a million base pairs. And each of these little blue boxes denotes a gene. So there's maybe 15 genes in this window. And this is the typical output of a GWAS study. So are people familiar with GWAS? I should have started out with that. I can explain.
I don't know about anybody else, but I cannot quite read.
So I'll explain
what the axes represent.
So I'll just recap briefly on GWAS. So what GWAS you're doing is very straightforwardly, you're phenotyping people, you're measuring some trait, like do they have a disease or not, or what height are they? And then you're looking for genetic variants whose genotype correlates with that phenotype. So you're grouping people based on their genotypes at different loci and saying, does that significantly predict my phenotype? And the output that you get from a GWAS is plotted here. So each dot is a genetic variant, so a place at which human beings differ genetically. On the y-axis, you're seeing negative log 10 of the p-value, so higher up meaning lower p-value. And you can see there's a very large clump of genetic variants that are all somewhat significant, or not genome-wide significant, but they're low-ish. And what this slide is supposed to convey is that, first of all, you'll have a very hard time trying to predict which, if any of these, is the causal variant. Typically, we don't assume that all of these are causal. It seems unlikely. But there may be one or two real causal variants in here, and you get this association because of population history, basically because of linkage disequilibrium. One of these mutations arose, the causal mutation arose on a certain haplotype way back in the past, and all of these other mutations have sort of been carried along for the ride. What that means is that...
What is the variable on the y-axis?
It is the negative log 10 of the p-value.
Minus log p.
So what happens is all of these genotypes are correlated with one another. If I know the genotype at this SNP, I can make a pretty good guess of the genotype at this SNP, and so on, based on population history. What that means is that when you do a genetic association study, even though there's only one or two or a handful of causal, true causal variants in this window, you get associations have many SNPs because the genotypes are correlated. They're not independent of one another.
And the bottom two, yes. Say polygons, there are a lot of weights stacked on top of each other because humans have a lot of DNA in common with each other. So you're maybe finding a proportionately a few of the dots separated.
I'm not quite sure I understand. I mean, at the bottom of this plot, or?
Yeah, so if your y-axis is measuring difference between people and humans,
so it's not quite difference between people. So it's imagine an ANOVA where I have some trait, I measure on my group of people, and then I genotype each of those people at a certain number of SNPs. Okay? And then I walk through those set of SNPs and I put people into different boxes based on their genotype. And I do an ANOVA on that. What I'm looking for is something that explains significant variation in my phenotype. So I'm looking for, effectively I'm looking for a significant, you know, regression going up or down or whatever.
If people in the sample don't vary at that locus, then you can't do the test at all.
So
it's only varying loci that are equal.
Correct. So one wouldn't typically do tests at monomorphic, so loci where there's no variation in the first place, because by definition, those are not very interesting for looking at variation between people.
Right. And what do you have from the right axis here? The combination?
So the kind of the standard in the field is to show recombination rate, and that's typically because recombination is the reason that you get these big blocks. Right? So you have recombination in the genome is not uniform. Right? There are regions of the genome that recombine much more often than other regions of the genome. At those regions, you tend to find a lot more independence of genotypes because there's just been much more recombination in past population history. The converse is also true. In regions where you've had very little recombination, you tend to find genotypes. You know, if I had a SNP over here, it pretty well predicts the genotype of the SNP in a very long way away because there hasn't been that much recombination in the past population history to break things up effectively, to break association between genotypes. And that's pretty much what you're seeing here. This is perhaps a recombination cold spot. There hasn't been a lot of recombination here. I'm not sure why you can't see the line, but we can make a reasonable stab at saying, well, there hasn't been a lot because all of these SNPs are associated, but it's biologically unrealistic to think that all of them are associated with the trait and they each have independent descent.
Sorry to make us dwell even longer on this slide, but I'm not. If the vertical axis is minus log 10p, then how does that right hand axis for the recombination rate work? Is that the color axis or what?
So I'm not quite sure. So normally you would see a trace. I picked this slightly at random. So normally what you would see with a recombination plot is you might see, for example, a line that denotes like a spike here saying, oh, this is a recombination hotspot or cold spot. It may be in this case, because I picked this really ugly example, that it's just down here. It's really low recombination. But it may be in there and I haven't possibly corrected. So to get back to the purpose of showing you this, so this is, by anybody's measure, this is a big piece of the genome. This is a megabase. This is a million bases. And a large number of them vary. So a large number of them potentially could be the causal variant. This is a variant for Alzheimer's, but the same is true for any trait pretty much that we've looked at. The second point to make, so any of these in principle could be causal, or none of them. It might not even be a genotyped SNP, just these could all be correlated with it. The second point is that there are many, many genes here, and it's not really clear which one might be an interesting, for example, drug target. So this is an output from GWAS, and we naturally end up with these sorts of questions about, well, which gene and which variant might I be interested in if I just wanted to design a drug? So that's the sort of question that my group is interested in thinking about. And the tool that we use, or one of the tools that we use to try and address that, is actually a very similar sort of approach, what we call QTL mapping, so quantitative trait locus mapping, But what we're interested in is are phenotypes that are measured, traits that are measured in cells rather than traits that are measured in whole organisms, let's say. So, and a little toy example of this would be, imagine I have two people, I have genotyped them at a bunch of SNPs denoted by these little boxes here. So I've genotyped them at loci that vary between people, and then I've measured some trait in a cell, for example, the amount of mRNA that's coming from that gene. And you can see in the toy example, I've got individual 2 is producing a little bit more. These pink squiggles are representations of mRNA. More mRNA coming from this individual's copy of the gene than this individual. And if we extend that to many people, what we're looking for is something like this. So we measure a trait like mRNA quantity, and then we do exactly what I was telling you previously. We also genotype people, and we group people based on their genotypes sequentially at each different locus until we find something like this. So we find association between genotype group and our trait of interest, in this case, gene expression.
Would you always be looking at the same type of cell, or are there some quantities that you can look from a skin cell?
Correct. So great question. Yes, we would. I mean, there are hundreds of, probably possibly thousands of different cell types in the body, and we know gene expression is incredibly specific. So certain genes are only expressed in neurons, other genes are only expressed in blood cells. People have done studies now in multiple different tissues. So you have studies from heart and brain and liver and so on. But again, even those are a sort of rough approximation. Because you're not, liver is not one cell type, it's many cell types, and so it's the brain, and people tend to kind of aggregate, for technical reasons, it's quite hard, so tend to take RNA from a population of cells and sort of look at the average, rather than looking at individual cell types, because that's harder.
So, let me see if I understand the difference between this and the previous one. The previous one, you were doing the same thing.
It's almost exactly the same thing, the only slight difference is the in the previous example, you're looking at a categorical phenotype.
Okay.
Case control. Here, you're looking at a quantitative phenotype. It's exactly right. It's exactly the same type of study.
And the ordering there, at the bottom, is a...
Yeah. So you could, like I said, you could just do ANOVA and say, right, is there some, the genotype explains some variation between my... Typically, we do it this way because of the way genetics works. We typically mostly expect what are called additive effects. So some additive effect of adding T alleles. So we usually order them in that way, but you don't have to. Yes?
But
you
say cell line 1, cell line 2, rather than individual 1, individual 2. What did you mean individual?
Well, it depends what kind of study. I mean, if you're looking at cell lines, individual and cell line are interchangeable. If you're looking at tissues, it's not cell lines anymore.
But you wouldn't have the genetic differences if these cell lines were from different individuals.
Correct. Correct. So perhaps we should say genetic background, regardless of what tissue of origin is and so on. What we're looking for is unrelated individuals or material from genetically unrelated individuals. And one of the reasons we do this is, as we mentioned, this is exactly the same sort of study that one can do for disease. And that means that aligning these sorts of results with disease results is quite a powerful tool. Another reason is that you can measure many traits in cells, not just gene expression. You can measure things like chromatin accessibility, which I'll explain in a minute, or things like methylation. And all of these can give you a better handle on what particular variants may or may not be doing. And by extension, if those also align with disease associations, perhaps some of the pathways that are being perturbed in disease.
And do you need to connect this with something in plant studies and so forth? Sometimes these TCLs are used when you don't know the genes. So you know that the chunk of the DNA is related to something.
That's exactly. So I think, there is no difference between that and this or this. You know, the reason we do these studies is we don't know the genes. And in many cases, even after you do the study, you don't know the genes, but you know that it's this bit and not, you know, the rest of the genome. Or at least you narrow it down by a certain amount. But certainly, it's unusual to get it to be confident that you've got down to a single gene. And that's to do with recombination rate and so on. Okay, so after all of that build-up, I'm not really going to talk to you about disease at all. And I'm going to take a risk and present stuff that I haven't really presented before, that's not published. So it's probably going to be a bit rough. But I'm ready for your criticism and comments. So I'm going to talk to you about one of the projects we've been doing to apply this idea of QTL mapping, quantitative trait locus mapping, to a trait called chromatin accessibility, which I'll explain. And the meat of the talk is going to be about how to infer interactions, causal interactions between different regions of the genome. That will make more sense when I explain what chromatin accessibility is. So the DNA, and I apologize if this is sort of, people know this already, but DNA is not linear in the cell. DNA is highly, highly compacted. You have 3 meters or so of DNA in each nucleus, if I remember rightly. So there's a very significant amount of compaction that's required to get that into a cell. And the way that's achieved is that it's wrapped around structures that are called nucleosomes that are sort of represented by this toy model here. You have histone octamer, 8 different histone molecules that are composed into a single unit around which the DNA is wrapped. And most of your DNA in any cell in your body is in that state. It's wrapped around the nucleosome. And that achieves 2 things. One, it performs this feat of compaction. So it compresses the DNA so that it can be stored in a very small space. The other thing it achieves is it's very important for this idea of gene regulation and gene expression. And the reason for that is that typically, there are exceptions to this, but typically when DNA is wrapped around these structures, around nucleosomes, it's not accessible to other things, for example, proteins. And the way gene expression happens is you get regulatory proteins, things called transcription factors and so on, that physically interact with the DNA. That's one of the ways that gene expression happens. So you have a regulatory protein that's floating around in the nucleus that comes into a particular site, a docking site called a transcription factor binding site, and sits there and then begins to mediate the process of gene regulation. So i.e. the recruitment of the machinery that is required to produce mRNA and extension protein. But these things, these nucleosomes, prevent that process from happening. And what we think one of the major reasons that you have these is it stops lots of spurious interactions happening. So proteins are not allowed to interact with bits of DNA in inappropriate ways, so meaning that your genes don't get expressed in development at the wrong time or in the wrong tissue.
So what is it that determines the segment of DNA on which this TF protein attaches?
If I knew the answer to that question, I could probably retire. I mean, that's been the subject of an incredibly long and still ongoing process of what are the rules that govern that connection.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you what we do know.
Because basically, according to your diagram, there isn't space between the other nucleosomes as far as you get at it.
Correct.
Between those two, there is room.
So we know there are 2 things that are important. So one, as you've said, is that there are no nucleosomes in here. And so this is what we refer to as open chromatin. So I should have said this structure of DNA plus nucleosome is referred to as chromatin. And this, so this is, you could call this closed chromatin or inaccessible chromatin, and this is open chromatin or accessible chromatin. And
does it vary between cell types and stages of cell development?
Very much so.
And then closed, and so that's how it regulates.
So I think there's a not unreasonable argument to say that that where the chromatin is open, so it is very cell type specific, it's very sometimes condition specific, developmental stage specific, this is one of the key things that determines cell kind of status. Like, why is a neuron and not a hepatocyte or a cardiomyocyte or whatever? Those are very, very different cells. Why are they different cells? Because they have different proteins. Why do they have different proteins? Because they express different genes. Why do they express different genes? Well, this, right? They have different bits of chromatin that's accessible or not. So that's one of the things that's important.
Presumably, yeah. In a particular area of body tissue is being built up, in that building process, something is making that arrangement.
Yes.
Somehow.
Yes. But how? So, I think, I mean, this gets into a very long question or long discussion about how, you know, this is all from one cell originally, with one chromatin landscape. So how do we get from there to 400 or 1,000 different cell types? And I think, you know, broadly speaking, what's thought to happen is you have cascading processes of, you know, one protein. So there are certain select proteins. So I know I just told you that this prevents proteins from interacting with DNA, but there are exceptions to that, and those are the key things. So some proteins can move these nucleosomes around. You may have heard of things called master regulators and so on. Those tend to be the things that are also involved in development and lineage specification and so on. So how do you get from pluripotent cells to three germ layers? Well, there are certain key factors, proteins, that are able to move these nucleosomes around. By moving them around and opening up certain bits and closing down other bits, you get different regulatory programs, which means you get different proteins and so on. And that process is cascading. So once you set up, you know, one lineage, then you get three lineages splitting off. Now, there's a big question as to how that actually... There must be some heterogeneity in the system for that to happen, but yeah, it's not an easy question to answer. And I think understanding the rules of this interaction is still, I would say, we're a long way away from having a kind of predictive model. We have plenty of data now, so in a sense, I can tell you, you know, what bits are open and closed in lots of different cells, but why is a different and harder question to answer.
Could you say for how long?
In certain circumstances, yes.
So, but I mean, is it for the whole life of the cell before mitosis, or is it just for some period?
So, I think it's hard to have a one rule, but so chromatin tends to be dynamic, but not quite perhaps as dynamic as gene expression. But I wouldn't want to be more concrete than that. It certainly does change, you know, depending on, you know, has a cell been invaded by a pathogen or is there an inflammatory response? So it is dynamic. It does change in response to the environment. But gene expression is even more dynamic, if that is helpful. Okay. So hopefully that has convinced you that chromatin accessibility, so the bits of the genome that are actually accessible, is an important thing to measure because it determines really how regulation happens. And if we go back to the beginning slide, you know, if most of the things that are causing disease or variability between people are changing gene expression, then these are good regions to look in for the causal variants. Because we know these are key points for regulation to happen. And happily, we can measure this, and I'll show you what it looks like in a second, using a different, you know, a variety of different kind of biochemical assays, which work on the same principle that this, effectively the same principle that the regulatory proteins themselves operate on. This piece of DNA is sort of open, it's naked, you can digest it with an enzyme, or you can insert a transposon in there. And we have good assays for this now. There's something called DNase 1 hypersensitivity. Yes?
Of course, we're discussing sometimes basic questions from that. Question: how often open chromatin is without genes, gene defects?
How often do you have regions of open chromatin far away from genes? Or defined far away, I guess.
I mean, that if an open chromatin region does not contain any gene.
So genes tend to be much larger than regions of open chromatin, first of all. It would be, I don't think you would ever have a single gene inside a region of open chromatin. So the gene would be much larger than the region of open chromatin. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
So, and your other question, when a gene is being expressed in a tissue, it tends to have open chromatin most significantly around its promoter. So, and it tends to be quite visible in the assay. I'll give you an example in a second. You also tend to get regions of open chromatin dotted throughout the gene in introns and so on. Those may be regulatory regions or other things, but you certainly do get regions of open chromatin that are far away from genes in the middle of nowhere.
But I guess another way to put that question would be, are they closer to genes than you would expect by chance on average, or are they randomly distributed in the genome relative to where the genes are?
They're certainly not random. They would be clustered around transcription, what are called transcription start sites, the beginning of genes, which is where all the regulatory activity tends to happen. But there are many just thrown around the genome. One of the reasons for that is we know that regulation can happen at a very long distance. There are certainly examples of that. And others, that many of them don't really do anything. So they're just open by chance. So how do you get transcription from closed chromatin? So that's a great question. So there's two slightly different things. So one is the protein, the regulatory protein, binding, physically binding with the DNA, covalently bonding to the DNA. But the second is, once that sort of machinery is in place, how do you get RNA from DNA? And I'm going to fail my biochemistry. I don't think we know actually exactly how Pol2, which is the molecule that does the transcription, actually traverses these. Because it's certainly true that when a gene is expressed, the DNA is still wrapped around nucleosomes. One explanation is it may not be wrapped quite as tightly. So there are different degrees of this, right? But it may not be wrapped quite as tightly around it. It may be slightly loosened away from the histone so that the Pol2 can traverse it. It may be that it's a very dynamic process of nucleosomes kind of being popped out and back in again as the Pol2 transcribes. But we know it must happen, right? It must happen because you get transcription in regions that you also have nucleosomes in.
Can a gene include DNA that wraps around several nucleosomes?
Oh yes, absolutely. So I should say the scale of this is 147 base pairs.
So, absolutely.
I mean, genes tend to be tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of base pairs in total length. So you will have hundreds or thousands of nucleosomal units throughout the body of the gene.
But the nucleosomes are not a problem for the transcription, but yet a problem for the
transcription. Well, so the difference is that the Pol2, the molecule or the machinery that does the transcription is not binding directly to the DNA. Okay, it's reading it. I mean, it's physically going through it in some sense, but it's not actually locked on to the DNA. But you know, it's something that I'm not a biochemist, and there are people who've studied chromatin structure for sort of 30-40 years, and I don't think we still really have. There are models of how it works, but it isn't intuitive to me really. If you have these things that are tightly bound, how do you get this big molecule kind of following them? So yeah, sorry, I wish I had a better answer. Okay, so yes, so we have assays that can measure this. They're high resolution, meaning that even though these things are small, they can detect them quite accurately to within a resolution of base pairs. And by high throughput, I mean it's possible to do these relatively straightforwardly, not in tens of thousands of people, but to do them in 100 people is not, we can do it. Okay,
But this is what it actually looks like. These are real data. And so this is a sequencing-based assay called ATAC-seq. I can explain how this works if people like, but effectively, this is a mechanism, or this is a molecular tool that preferentially cuts DNA out of these regions and makes it available for sequencing. Okay? So when I run this assay, what I end up with is a library of lots and lots of short DNA molecules that I can put on a sequencer, and then I can map them to the genome. And when you map them to the genome, you can visualize that as these peaks and troughs. And these are not quite exactly the depth of reads, but it's not dissimilar. So this is, effectively, this is saying, you know, I had some reads, some DNA molecules that came from here and here and here, but I had a lot coming from this region. And another clump coming from this region.
And even though they're short sequences, and even though they all have this DNA type sensitivity common, they will map to unique locations of the genome.
Usually, yes. I mean, so it depends on how long your reads are. So if you have 20 base pair reads, it becomes a bit tricky because there are regions that are, you know, we know there's lots of repetitive sequence. In this case, these are 75 base pairs, so they're 150 bases long. You basically have a molecule when you sequence one and then the other, and that helps you do the positioning a bit better as well. And so, but we also have ways of, if it doesn't map properly, then we don't use it. You get mapping quality. So one thing that's common to do
this is therefore where you could get missing data dependent upon the structure of this more research.
For example, if it was highly repetitive, if you had a sequence that you were interested in that was found at many locations in the genome, and you then got a molecule from one of those, but when you tried to map it back, it was equally mappable to one of 100. Yes, short answer, yeah, that does happen. Thankfully, the regions where that's most problematic tend to be I'm not going to say the least interesting, but they tend to be regions of the genome called centromeres, for example, where not a lot is going on in terms of making proteins or gene regulation and so on. There are certainly examples of this that are interesting for proteins, for example, copied genes. We know that happens a lot. So yes, it does happen, but it's not a problem for a reasonably large fraction of the genome. And I guess the other defense against that, or the other, you can also compute that before you do your experiment. You can say, well, which regions of the genome are going to be mappable? And you could say that by saying, well, I find this sequence only in one location in the genome, whereas I find this sequence in 5,000. So a priori, that doesn't look very mappable. But so the features to pick out here are, first, what we call peaks. So this is we're calling an ATAC peak, but this is just a really a simple model to go through the genome and say there is some enrichment of reads in this particular region more than I expect under some uniform model. And likewise here, and you could see that's a fairly, you know, coarse summary of this. There's lots more interesting kind of structure going on in this region. It's just a sort of quick and dirty way of saying, you know, this bit is a bit more open than I see in most of the rest of the genome. Likewise, this is as well. These are called peaks. And other bits of annotation here. So these are SNPs. So these are regions that vary, you know, genetic variants between people. And this is the beginning of a gene. So this goes to your question about, you know, where are they in relation to genes? This is a gene. This is a gene promoter. This is the start of the gene. So if this gene has been expressed, POL2 is being recruited in here and then going off in this direction. This is often what we find as a region of open chromatin. Yeah.
Just stop me if you think I'm asking too much.
No, I much prefer this. We may be here for a while, though I'm fine.
But if we're in danger of overrunning, tell us, because
we're about a third of the way through. I'm happy to stay as long as you want, though. I'm not so...
reproducible is this substructure in the same cell type?
In the same cell type?
pretty reproducible in terms of could I tell you which cell it came from?
No.
Yeah.
Not the locations of all the chromatin, but this fine
substructure. Oh, I see. Yeah, that's a good question. I would say certainly less reproducible than this kind of coarse summary of open or not, you know, peak or not. I can't give you a number, I'm afraid. I don't know. So one thing that this structure does actually reflect is the positions of nucleosomes. Even though I've told you these regions are open chromatin, in fact, in reality, what's happening is it's a little bit fuzzier than that. So there certainly are nucleosomes in this region. They're just not in that region in every cell. I guess what you have to remember in this case is this is an average. I've taken a population of cells, and I've done this assay in each one, and then sort of glommed all of the data together. So you're looking at an average. So you could have some cells where it is actually closed, and other cells where it's open. And that can be dynamic. But I would say, overall, it is a fairly reproducible assay. Okay. And now we get into what I was really going to talk about, or what we're interested in. So that's a really beautiful assay. It works well, and it's quite easy to do on the scale of molecular biology things. One thing you can then do is the sorts of QTL studies I was talking about earlier, where instead of doing this in one cell line or one genetic factor or one person or whatever, I can do this in many people, and I can do that same process of stratifying by genotype. So I can take 100 people, I can measure open chromatin in each of them, and then I can group them based on their genotype at this SNP and see, do I see any association, for example, between chromatin openness and genotype in this region, or this region, or any region. And that's part of the reason you do this sort of, you know, grouping things into peaks, is that you then treat this as a phenotype, you treat this as a trait. And you can kind of summarize this in a variety of ways, but the simplest way is you count the reads. So, for example, I will count the number of reads that fall between this and this band in individuals, in 100 individuals, and then group those people by their genotypes and walk across this region and say, oh, look, so if I group people by their genotypes at this SNP, so the bar in red there, if you can see it, this is the pattern I find. Your CC here, you're open, that's the red peak. If you're TC, you're sort of semi-open, right? Light blue peak. And if you're TT, you're just closed. And that's a QTL. That's a chromatin accessibility QTL. So you've got a variant in there, not necessarily that variant, but probably that one, which regulates chromatin accessibility in that region. We'll get there, yes. Yeah, that's what I'm going to talk about in a minute. But just in principle, if people are on board with the idea of doing that, grouping people by genotype and finding associations between accessibility and genotype, and that's kind of what we're up to. And you're right, there's another one there, but we'll get to that in a sec. Okay, so that's what I was originally going to talk to you about. It was published last year. We wrote a paper on a model to do this sort of analysis of grouping people by genotype. And I will summarize it by just saying that it was a model to deal with some of the technical artifacts you can find in these sorts of data. And we also had a way of boosting statistical power, which I can discuss at length if anybody's interested. I suppose the key thing to take from this is that we could find quite a lot of these in, by the standards of the field, a pretty puny sample size in 24 people. And that's partly because we thought a reasonable model to do things, but we found 2,700 of these at a not, you know, that's not a great FDR, but it's not terrible, and, you know, we find maybe 1,800 at FDR 5% and about 1,200 at 1%. One of the other things that's important for this talk is that, and I want you to ignore the pie chart for a moment and just look at this plot, is that the locations of associated variants is massively
enrich in a fairly small region of the genome. Now, what we've done here is we've taken all of those associations and aggregated them together and said something very simple and dumb, which is, where is the most associated, the SNP that has the lowest p-value? Again, remember, I'm doing this test, grouping people by genotype, do it for lots of SNPs across the region, and then I find the one that has the lowest p-value. And I ask, where does that SNP sit in relation to my original peak of interest? And this is aggregated over everything, over 2,700 that we found. And this little gray bar, which is probably too narrow, denotes inside the peak. So if we go back a second, that's here, right? And everything else is outside the peak. And this red line just denotes that. So on the y-axis, what I'm showing you is the fold enrichment. So the most associated SNP is something like 30 or 40 fold more likely than any other SNP to fall inside the peak. The x-axis here denotes distance. This is quite a big distance, actually. This is a megabase, so this is a million bases upstream of the peak and a million bases downstream. But all this is supposed to illustrate is that these things are not occurring randomly with respect to the peak. They're occurring massively more likely to occur inside than outside the peak. And that's a very, very useful piece of information. And the other thing to note is that this isn't one peak. This is many, many, many peaks. This is aggregated across a couple of thousand that we find. So this is a general property that we find. So peak SNPs that are associated with chromatin accessibility tend to be found inside the peak. One thing we can reasonably conclude from this is that the genetic variants that are affecting chromatin are relatively common. Even in the sample size of 24, we can find quite a lot. By extension, they must have fairly large effects, or at least some of them do, or a larger proportion than perhaps affect other traits in humans. And this point I was trying to hammer there. So they're also tend to be found in a relatively small genomic space. So this is of the order, the average size of a peak is about 100 or 200 or 500 or maybe 1,000 bases, but that's tiny relative to the size of the genome. What that means is that if you're interested in causal variants, if you're interested in things that are actually affecting gene regulation, looking inside peaks is quite a good thing. It's a good place to go.
Not clear, but to what extent is this cycle argument, because the exact sequence itself is targeting to causal DNA?
You mean you're more likely to?
There is.
Yeah.
So if you looked at that picture, then it's sort of a density of cross regions.
Mm-hmm.
And presumably the algorithm defines the proper chromatin based on some physical regions.
I don't think we do anything that fancy, but yeah, I mean, we call peaks based on some threshold on the type.
So wouldn't that pattern then imply that this lifts you away to discover with?
No, so that would be true if we had to discover SNPs. But we don't. So we know where the SNPs are beforehand. And we don't place any, we're agnostic about which SNP, before we test, which SNP could be causal. So we test every single SNP within a region of a million base pairs upstream and downstream. I'm not sure if that answers your question, though. Okay. So the second thing that we kind of spotted earlier was that you can get a little bit more complicated than this. You can find genetic variants that associate with chromatin here, but also in an adjacent region, which is physically distinct. This is about 2,000 base pairs between here and here. But you can see, if you group people by genotype at this SNP, accessibility here and here correlates. Okay? So if you're CC, you have open chromatin here, and you also have open chromatin here. likewise, if you're TT, you have closed and, well, not closed, but less. And this is significant. This is a significant association of both. What's interesting is this is the best, most significantly associated SNP for here and for here. And what it implies, perhaps, is that there is some interaction between these two separate regions of chromatin. And we know that, as I said, so the genome is not linear, it's wrapped. And that wrapping has you know, it occurs at this local scale of, you know, nucleosomes, but it also occurs at much, much bigger scales over megabases. And that's kind of what we're interested in as well. So I won't go through this in huge detail, but we know, for example, that there are loops formed during gene regulation. So for example, I have a region that in the linear space, in the sort of 2D, you know, this looks distinct from this, but in 3D space they come together. And that's, we know that's crucial for gene regulation. And that goes to your question earlier about, you know, where are these regions with respect to genes? Sometimes they're megabases away, but they actually physically interact by looping. So they come together in 3D.
So where you have a loop in that your curve crosses itself, does that mean that at that point the two parts of the gene are in contact, bound together?
So it certainly means they can be contacting each other, but it may not be a kind of constant thing. It may be dynamic. But what we know, so there are elements in the genome called enhancers, originally discovered in bacteria, and their function is to increase the rate of expression. And typically they function by folding over and interacting with the promoter of the gene and POL2.
I mean, the point of the question actually was, if there is some influence which can travel along the gene, if you have a loop to go around the surface.
I see. I suppose it's possible. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think we know.
But of course, if they're actually not really in contact where they cross on your diagram, then there is not a strong connection between them.
No. No, we don't think so. But I guess, so certainly, I think it's possible that you could have, you know, POL2 going around and looping. What we do know is that transcription is pretty sort of leaky. So in the sense that the POL2 molecule does tend to fall off quite a lot, and it just restarts, or another molecule comes in. And depending on how, you know, how often these things interact, that rate can increase or decrease. So by active you mean like transcriptionally active, or?
I don't know enough genetics to say, but doing something as opposed to, as I understand it, not DNA, it doesn't.
It do very much. Certainly, yes, things that loop tend to be more interesting. They tend to be functional in the sense that they can regulate gene expression.
Could you go back?
Yeah.
Could it be, for example, where you've got a yellow and a green marker sort of in contact at either end of the loop, that the green bit was active in the sense of being transcribed because it was being touched by the, perhaps temporarily, by the yellow bit, which is active in the sense of promoting transcription?
So what is that's the model that people have in mind. So The thought is that you have some machinery to do transcription, POL2, and sort of associated proteins, and those get to the beginning of the gene and they sort of travel down the body. Then you have these other things, which may be physically far away, but which come together, which modulate that process.
But that doesn't involve anything going across and going round the loop again. It's two different things being done by the active bits of two ends.
Correct. So at the sort of enhancer locus, what you may have is a bunch of proteins that recruit more POL2. So you may have some recruitment of POL2 at the beginning of the gene, and when this thing loops over, it recruits even more, and so you get more and more and more transcription. And so that's perhaps a function for enhancers. So, and you know, a way that that might be important is, for example, in immune response, you need response very, very, very quickly. You know, you need to respond on the order of minutes. We know organizing nucleosomes takes hours, but that looping is very quick. So if you have one quick way of activating that, then that can massively increase expression in a very short time scale. But it's not due to things traveling around the loop, it's due to bringing other accessory proteins in contact with the gene promoter. So we're about an hour in, and I haven't really got any statistics yet. I mean, it is here, we're getting there, but I don't know how long people want to stay or if people are feeling sleepy or whatever. I could happily sort of skim through it. Any thoughts? What does the chair say?
The chair is just looking at it.
Okay. Well, we'll try another 10 minutes, and then if people are feeling a bit sleepy,
yeah.
I can give you the gist.
We're running, so.
Okay. Fine. Okay, so maybe I'll skip this bit. Okay, so what we're interested in now is using genetics to try and infer whether this sort of thing is going on, whether there is an interaction between two regions of the genome. And the reason for doing that is that there are other experimental methods for doing it, but they're hard, they're very low resolution. Key thing is that they don't tell you anything about causality. They don't tell you that, you know, these two things interact and one is influencing the other. They just say they interact, they stick together. So you don't know. They can stick together for all sorts of reasons. With genetic variation as a perturbant, you can perhaps do something a little bit more involved or interesting. And so we're going to start with a model that thinks about not single peaks, but pairs of peaks, okay? So peak J and K, which I will come back to, just think of a pair of peaks, and what we're going to consider is pairs of peaks that are bounded, so they're not at sort of massive distances from one another, they're at a reasonable 500 kb or less, peak J and peak K, and we're going to consider SNPs, or genetic variants, in a window surrounding those peaks. So each of these X's denotes, in this toy model, a genetic variant. We'll refer to this space as the cis window. That just means that the variants in here are likely to act in cis, but we don't need to get too bogged down in that. And there is a notation for the cis window that I'll introduce you to in a second. And we're going to consider a bunch of different hypotheses. So one, our null is that there is no QTL, there is no genetic variant affecting chromatin accessibility at either peak J or peak K. And we have a set of alternatives of sort of increasing complexity, maybe. One is that there is a QTL, but it just affects one peak, and that's it. That's the sort of standard thing. And then there are three other more complicated ones. This is probably not the best name for this. Linkage, what I'm referring to as linkage here, means a hypothesis that there are two QTLs driven by two independent genetic variants. So one is driving peak J, one is driving peak K. Yeah. Pleiotropy means that there is a single genetic variant driving variation at both peaks, but the key is it's just one, not two. So the same thing is driving variation independently of both of those. And the final one is causality. So meaning that I have a genetic variant in, for example, peak J that affects peak J, which in turn affects peak K. Okay? And that might be the one we're interested in for these interactions between different regions of the genome.
And could you have it, as it were, your lots of error diagrams combined so that J affects K and the effect on K leads back to J.
In principle, yes, I guess, but we don't model that. It's too complicated. Okay, so those are our hypotheses. The first thing I'm going to show you is a regression model to think about each of those, and this is just, these are just probabilities, but to describe this space of null and alternatives, we're going to think about, so here's some notation. So we have no genetic effect, and we have a vector of phenotypes, in this case read counts, at each individual at peak j. So yj is a vector of length n, where n is my sample size across all my individuals, at the first peak, j, and yk is the same, but at k. And this is under the null, so conditional on phi, there's no QTL. Or I have a QTL at peak j, which is mediated by some variant whose identity I don't know, variant L, and XL is a vector of genotypes. Okay? So in this case, I have variant XL mediates a QTL, a genetic effect on chromatin, on YJ, and nothing's going on at YK. Or the converse, I have nothing going on at YJ, but something going on. Sorry, nothing going on at J, but something going on at K. And if you remember these other hypotheses, so linkage, or what we're calling linkage, is two independent variants, L and M, independently affecting J and K. Pleiotropy, where I have XL, the same variant affecting both J and K. And finally, this causal path, so I have variant L affects J, which in turn affects K. So K is now conditional on J, J is conditional on L, and the converse of that, so I have a variant L affecting K, which now affects J. So that's the essence of the model that we're going to talk about.
So why do you multiply the probability?
Because you're interested in both the outcomes. You want the joint probability of the observation of there is or is not a QTL at both simultaneously. You don't want to model or.
I just was wondering if there was some independence or something.
Oh, I see what you mean. So the probability that we're actually trying to get to is the joint probability of the recounts at both J and K, conditional on some hypothesis of how they're related. So that's why you're multiplying. Does that make sense? Okay. And we're going to put these all into a giant mixture model. So these probabilities we just talked about, joint probabilities on J and K, conditional on H, we're going to sum over all of the hypotheses that I just talked about. So null and the alternatives, the different flavors of the alternatives. And we're going to have some mixture parameters that tell you something about the weightings. And those mixture parameters are going to be specific for a given pair. And that's useful for, I'll show you why that's useful. And then we're going to take the product over all pairs that we consider in the genome, which is a lot. And the reason for doing that we'll also come on to in a second, but in principle what we want to do is that there is some information that's, this is a hierarchical model, right? There are going to be some pieces of information that are shared between all pairs of peaks that's useful, that we can help to resolve these different hypotheses. Those are some data. So we have 100 individuals. Now this model looks kind of nice, but it's not tractable for two reasons. We don't know the causal variant, which comes into all of these statements. We don't know where the causal variant is a priori. And we don't know this thing, this conditional. We don't know how one peak affects another. We don't know the causal effect of one peak on another. So to solve those two problems. First problem, where's the causal variant? Well, I kind of alluded to this before. Well, we don't know, but on average, we can say
we would place a higher prior in certain places than other places, right? So inside the peak is more likely, we think, on average, than outside the peak. So all of that just to say, if I can incorporate some degree of annotation, if I can have SNPs that are annotated as being inside or outside various regions, that can help me prioritize. I'll skip that. And so what we put on, what we need to do is integrate over all SNPs effectively, and we want to place a prior that's empirical, really, that we're going to estimate from data that says which SNP is causal. Okay, so we're now gone from a situation where we know the causal variant to one where we don't, and we're just going to treat it probabilistically and try and integrate over it. And again, I could go through the model for that, how we actually do that, but it's basically the softmax function, and we're thinking about, the key thing to take from this is that there are different types of information. Most importantly, annotation, so where the variant is in the genome, that we're going to learn from data across all pairs of peaks in the genome. So that's the crucial thing. The prior is going to be a function of these hyperparameters, lambdas, which are shared. So you can estimate them across all pairs of peaks, which in turn explains why we're taking this this product across all peak pairs. Sorry.
Why do you think that there is something in the element modeling that is shared between physically distant places?
So when I'm saying sharing, what I mean is
I mean philosophical. That somehow the apes common. I don't mean shared.
In principle, right, these regions of open chromatin are in different parts of the genome, but they're not all regulated in different ways, right? We know. Yes. Yeah, it's you don't have a different protein that opens up every single one of those different regions in the genome. And the reason we know that is because there are, in each cell type, there are at least 100,000 of them, and there are only 20,000 genes. So we know there must be some sharing. Right? There must be regions that are opened and closed by different, by the same protein even. You don't look like you believe that.
No, I'm thinking about this assumption that there are common regulators for different species.
So maybe...
Wait, look, there is a ground to assume this. I'm not sure if there are known things that do this.
So I will agree partially that I don't think we know everything, but we certainly know, for example, things like the MERS complex, the SWI-SNF complex.
There are more regulators
that are correct. That are called chromatin remodelers. So there's a class of proteins that are particularly important in cancer, actually, that are known modulators or remodelers of chromatin.
They are somehow affected by this lambdas.
Exactly. Correct. So the sort of some of the properties of open chromatin are shared between different regions, meaning that you can learn something about where variants that affect that are in general, that are not specific to one peak, but that look like they might be similar across many peaks. So that, you know, if that doesn't work, our model is dead. And that's the essence of it, is why does this work? We hope it works. Is because there's some commonality, okay? So, the other thing, this is very weak. This is the best I could come up with. So we're going to use, are people familiar with Mendelian randomization? So, again, we can discuss afterwards, but Mendelian randomization is a technique to estimate the causal effect of one trait on another trait, using genotype as an instrumental variable, okay? And conceptually, the idea is that you have two traits, and if one is affected by genotype, and that trait, the first trait, also has a causal effect on the second trait, and the second trait should be conditionally independent of genotype. So if you think of a DAG, genotype, trait one, trait two, if these
traits are causally related, then this is conditionally independent of this under some assumptions. But we can discuss exactly how, there are lots of assumptions and it's not a perfect technique by any means. But this is what we're going to use to estimate this tricky conditional, which is the effect, the causal effect of K on J, actually, or J on K. We use something called two-stage least squares. And yeah, people may be tiring. We rewrite this entire model now using Bayes factors. So we now have a prior, which is a SNP level prior, and a Bayes factor that's specific to each of these different hypotheses. Okay. And that's what our new likelihood function looks like. So you have a product over all pairs of peaks and a summation over what we're calling regional Bayes factors, but this is this is summed over our set of hypotheses.
What is the source of your prime probabilities?
So which ones? These guys?
Well, the pi n on pi jk's and so.
So the pi jk's are empirical priors. So they're not true priors, you don't write into them beforehand. They're a function of the hyperparameters, the lambdas, which we're talking about, the annotations and so on. So those are actually learned from data.
Okay.
There are other priors set in here to allow us to write
that. That is the Mendelian process.
Say?
That is the Mendelian process in operation.
So the Mendelian specifically comes into here. And it effectively describes how, or it gives you a Bayes factor which supports or not the hypothesis that one trait is causally linked to another trait. Okay. And it's based on the idea that if you have a causal effect on one trait, if a trait has a causal effect on another trait, and they're both regulated by genetics, there's some conditional independence. Okay. So I'll just say that the things that come out of this model that are kind of interesting for us, one, these mixture parameters, which tell us at a given locus what hypothesis is the highest posterior probability. The annotation hyperparameters, so these lambdas that say, you know, which annotations are kind of interesting. But maybe the most interesting thing are things that tell us about, you know, which pairs of peaks are causal or which are pleiotropy, which are so on and so forth. And we do this in a two-stage process because it's too complicated to do it otherwise, so we estimate variant level things first and then fix. Okay, maybe I'll just show you some examples first. Okay, so this is the example we had right at the beginning, and here's what our model says about it. So the way to read these is ignore the diagonals. The off diagonals show you the posterior probability of an interaction between, you know, these two peaks. And you can compare the off diagonals and this, which these are the probabilities that the model, the posterior probabilities of the model says it likes for linkage versus a causal interaction from peak one to peak two. Okay? So the model, the posterior probability for this particular instance is 0.99. It really does like that this has a causal effect on this. And so the intuition here about why it likes this so much is partly because this genotype explains a lot of variance in this peak as well as this peak, meaning that this thing is conditionally independent of the genotype when you condition on this. But also that, if you remember these variant level annotations, so there's no SNP in here that explains this as well as this SNP, right? So the model is saying, well, I don't really like the idea that there are two causal variants here because I just can't find one that does as good a job as this. And I know from looking, you know, this sharing property or the idea that there's some hierarchy, I know that the causal SNPs are much more likely to be in here than outside. So I've got the best model, the model I like is that this is a single causal variant which affects this, which in turn affects this. Okay. And so that could be happening. So there could be a snippet here that we've missed, that we haven't unified. That's absolutely true. So the argument against that, I guess, is, you know, the genotyping data is reasonably high quality. We should be getting most things down to 1% allele frequency in the population. But it could be that's one of the, you know, that's something that doesn't go into the model, so it doesn't know about it, so it could certainly be happening. And you can begin to resolve more complex situations. So this is now getting tricky, right? You've got lots of peaks, and some of them, this is all in an intron of a gene, and this is what the diagram looks like. So now the model says, well, I like causal from peak 1 to peak 2, 3, and 4. So this is peak 1, 2, 3, 4. I get high posterior probability for this thing being causal, and none of these other ones being causal. But then if I, now this is slightly confusing, on the sub-diagonal, you've got the probabilities for this linkage idea, so that there are two independent variants. And on the, over the diagonal, we've got the probabilities for the pleiotropy. So these are all from the same model fit, and it's just saying, okay, well, I really like the idea that this, there's a variant here that's causal, and I sort of like the idea that there's some pleiotropy, but I'm not as super excited about that. But in principle, you know, a model might be genotype, peak one, but then independently affects all three of these things. Okay? But it's not intended to convince you that this one particular block, because, you know, we've solved the problem. It's more to show you that the model gives you some kind of nice probabilistic weighting on what it thinks is going on. Yes?
Number 099 of the picture. On this picture, what would be the number?
Right, so the scales here, so for the causal, still quite strong, above 0.9, I guess. It's hard, kind of hard to see with the scale. For the kind of model of, you know, so if we think about this, right, remember we're considering pairs of peaks. So this is saying, for example, pleiotropy between peak two and peak three, that's that block there. Quite confident about that. Not so confident about pleiotropy between peak four and peak two. And what's going on is it's saying, well, there's some genetic effect here. There's some genetic effect here, and I don't find a SNP in here that I like, and I don't find a SNP in here that I like, so the best model for me is really that there's some other SNP somewhere else that I haven't really looked at, or not inside either of these peaks, it's here, that's affecting both of them independently. So there's no interaction, this is not driving this, it's that they're both being affected by some other SNP somewhere else, right? But so the absolute number, though, it's hard to say, I guess, on the color scale, this might be about 0.3, might be about 0.5.
Okay. So I think, right, 25 past 9. I'll give you the final example, and I guess we can wrap up. So this is this idea of linkage where we have two variants, both affecting a peak, two different peaks. And this is, again, an intuition behind why, so here we're showing these diagrams again. Here the model does not like causality at all. It's saying there's no causal link between peak 1 here and peak 2. I really like the idea that there is some linkage going on, i.e. there are two independent variants. And again, the reason for that is here we have a SNP, a nice candidate causal, like looking like a causal SNP, sitting inside this peak. And we have another one over here sitting inside this peak. And this one associates with this very nicely, and so does this. So it says, the most likely hypothesis is that this is affecting this is affecting this, and they're independent of each other. Okay?
All right.
Do you have a mechanism for how it is?
Yes, right there. So they're, you know, they're in reasonable LD with each other. So are you familiar with R squared? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, so I'm happy to keep going on about this for as long as you like. It gets super complicated. You've got lots of other interesting things. Okay, so I've told you about a hierarchical model to infer these interactions between regulatory elements. The model uses mixtures of different sorts of approaches, Mendelian randomization, to try and infer causal links, and the nice thing is we can infer these things genome-wide. It's useful for fine mapping, and more generally, I think the thing for us we're interested in is understanding, you know, these causal interactions are hard to find, they're hard to be sure about. Can we learn something about the properties of causal interactions? Like, do they, how far do they tend to be apart? Do they tend to be very far? Are they close? What's the distribution look like? And we can learn that because we have tens of thousands of these things. And Natsuhiko Kumisaka is the very talented postdoc in my group who has been doing this in association with Andrew Knights, who generated some really beautiful data. And thank you for having the patience to last an hour and a half.
Well, thank you for keeping going.
Not at all. What was the challenge you posed me at the beginning? It was that if I didn't explain protein
I forget that now.
I do want to say, you know, we haven't made it easy for you to tell your story, but for me this has been a safe environment to sort of get to grips with the